The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
This is a very special evening. I'm a sixth grade teacher formerly, and I have the honor of introducing Randy Weingarten. How about her job? She is the president of the 1.5 million member American Federation of Teachers. Perhaps you read her pieces in the Sunday New York Times or seen her on TV marching on the front line for a cause. The New York Daily News says she's tough, savvy, and has smarts to share. And whether you agree with all her positions, many are controversial or not, there is no question she's a great advocate for making things better for kids. Let's welcome Randy Weingarten.
My official copy hasn't come from Amazon yet, so my dog-eared copy is with me tonight of this delightful, wonderful, important, impressive, compelling, and must-read book. I get to be very short at this podium right now. Today is the publication date, the actual publication date of Diane's book. And I get to introduce Dr. Ravitch to all of you. Now, you're saying, what is the New Yorker doing in Philadelphia introducing Dr. Ravitch? But as you know, once you get arrested in a town, you are of the town. So, and I notice there's no cops with handcuffs today. So, you know, I would normally do, as I'm on my tippy toes, I would normally tell you how many books Diane has written, 10, how many distinguished roles she's had, serving more presidents than I can actually recite, how long we've known each other, over 2 decades, she won't let me tell you anything more, how we are both addicted to Twitter, she has many, many more followers than I do, but you can read all of that in Wikipedia. I think about Diane differently. I think about Diane the way the kids that I taught in Brooklyn used to hold me to, the standards they used to hold me to. And what they would say to me often after they trusted me was, Ms. Weingarten, you have to walk your walk, not just talk the talk. And Diane walks the walk every single day. She is a fierce advocate for our democracy, for our just society, for our children, for those who work with children, and for our public schools and the roles that those schools have in our society. You all know she is a highly respected educator and historian, but she has become a beloved, and when I say beloved, I mean a beloved activist and leader. And here's why. Diane is as brilliant as she is compassionate. Those who know her would say she is as compassionate as she is brilliant. And about a decade ago, we both watched Mayor Bloomberg in New York City take this concept of accountability and distort it in such an anti-democratic and anti-children way that she started her own journey of thinking about what was going on in terms of education. She looked at the reforms that were going on at that point, the ones that were gussied up as choice and competition, and she saw that they didn't work. And she spoke truth to power in a way that nobody else could. But what she's done now is even more
impressive and more important.
Because with this new book, Diane doesn't simply pull back the curtain on jargon or on privatization or profitization or test obsession or austerity mongers. What she does is she talks with great truth about what is working and what isn't working, with a clarity and a consistency that lacks jargon, that lacks pomposity, that in its simplicity is so compelling that it's hard to walk away from it. And I'm so delighted that she's doing this in Philly on the first day that this book comes out because of what you all have gone through in Philly. With the austerity, with the way in which schools have opened this week, without art, without music, without libraries, without nurses, without counselors, kids sitting on the floor because there's not enough desks, classes swollen to 60 kids, multiple grades sharing the same classrooms. What Diane has done for us is she has created a context about why the things that have happened in the last few years are wrong and what we need to actually ensure we reclaim the promise and the potential of public education, and with that, our democracy, and with that, our society. So it is my great honor and privilege to introduce to you Dr. Diane Ravitch.
So I wanted to thank Randy because she came here specifically to introduce me, and I am very grateful to her. I'm grateful to her for her friendship, for her leadership, for the courage that she shows in standing up for teachers. And I'm very happy to be at the Philadelphia Free Library, particularly because today is the day that my book is published, and I can't tell you what that means to an author to be on publication date. And as I was sitting in the room back there, which I guess is called the green room, I looked on Amazon and I just discovered that my book is number 105 on the first day. And I know from years of looking at Amazon that a lot of the books ahead of it are cookbooks. It's the number one ranked book in public policy on Amazon.com. And it just came out today. So I'm really excited and pumped. I'm also excited to be here in Philadelphia. You are ground zero. The state of Pennsylvania is the ground zero for the destruction and privatization of public education. When I hear the stories, and I want to gather them because I want to write about them, of schools without guidance counselors, schools without social workers, schools where the libraries have been closed, and then you say, why aren't the children learning? They're missing something. Most parents wouldn't stand for this. Why do we permit it to happen? Well, before I go into my talk about the book, I want to mention to you that last spring I helped to start an organization to help fight back. It's an organization that will be a PAC to fight for public education. We won't raise much money, but what we'll do is hand out a good housekeeping seal of approval to those candidates in school board races that are actually fighting for public education, because there's so many of what we call AstroTurf groups that are misnamed and where no one knows who really is for public education. So we're a group of parents, parent activists, teachers, scholars, and the group is called the Network for Public Education. And we will be endorsing candidates. We already have endorsed a few. In fact, we just had a winning slate in Bridgeport, Connecticut the other day that's probably going to fire the new board, which is the Working Families Party group, is probably going to be firing your old superintendent, Paul Vallis. So I'm going to ask you, I know your cell phones are turned off, but I'm going to ask you if you're interested and if you have the possibility of making this note that you should text four. I don't know how to do this sort of thing, but I'm telling you. You text 4-NPE, and the number you put in is 888-777, and you will get alerts about your schools in Pennsylvania and specifically in Philadelphia because we follow schools across the country. Now, I'll say it again. The text is 4, the number 4-NPE, and then you put in the little box where you write something, 888-777. I hope that's correct. Now, what I want to do is tell you how my book starts. It starts with a couple of quotations that kind of summarize what I'm about and what the book's about. First of all, what I consider to be the most famous lines of John Dewey's, and it's a message, I think, that pertains to what's going on in public education today. What the best and wisest parent wants for his own child, that must the community want for all of its children. Any other ideal for our schools is narrow and unlovely, and acted upon, it destroys our democracy. We don't live that. We live in a world where we want the best for our children, and we're allowing other children to have circumstances that we would not tolerate for our children. So I would like to remind us of those words because that's the theme of this book. The other quotation in the beginning of the book is from a crusty old conservative. And it's John Adams who said in 1785, "The whole people must take upon themselves the education of the whole people and be willing to bear the expenses of it. There should not be a district of 1 mile square without a school in it, not founded by a charitable individual, but maintained at the public expense of the people themselves." That's the definition of public education. And I asked my editor if it was possible to put in a quatrain somewhere, and she said, "No, that page is already filled up. You can't get that in the book anymore. It's too late." So I'm going to tell you what I didn't get in the book, but I keep hearing it in my head all the time. And this is an old English saying, it's a couple of hundred years old. It goes like this: "The law doth punish man or woman that steals the goose from off the common, but lets the greater felon loose that steals the common from the goose." Now, the Pennsylvania State Constitution says, and this is my last quotation, "The General Assembly shall provide for the maintenance and support of a thorough and efficient system of public education to serve the needs of the Commonwealth." And note that the state constitution does not say that each town and each school district is on its own, but that it is the responsibility of the state of Pennsylvania to provide for the maintenance and support of public education in every part of Pennsylvania. You cannot let a district go bankrupt and then hand it over to a charter operator for profit. Now, these days we hear this term reform thrown around, and we're supposedly engaged in this era of school reform, but somehow the term reform has become corrupted. It refers to budget cuts, to firing teachers, firing social workers, firing guidance counselors, firing librarians, closing public schools, turning public dollars over to private management, to entrepreneurs, and pretending that test scores are the most important outcome of schooling. All of this is called reform. Many teachers and principals today, and I have met them all over the country, feel that somehow, in ways that they don't understand, they've become public enemies. They're disrespected. Sometimes it seems that eliminating public education has become the goal of this movement that calls itself school reform. This is nuts. So what I've described in the book, and I should mention that I had a debate with the editor about the title, because Reign of Error is kind of a hard name. You're thinking of the rain, R-A-I-N, but no, it's R-E-I-G-N. Lots of people can't spell. But the other title, she said, "Well, what if we just call the book," because she had read it and she loved it, and she's a distinguished editor at Knopf. And she said, "What if we just call it Hoax?" We thought about that for about a week, and we thought, too sensational. Can't do that. I'm a scholar. But what the book describes is a series of hoaxes. The first hoax is called No Child Left Behind. So 12 years ago, Congress passed this promise because they had been told there was a Texas miracle. That was a hoax. There was no Texas miracle. And now the whole country's stuck with this regime of carrots and sticks and testing kids every year, and it's a giant hoax. And then we have the next hoax called Race to the Top. Race to the Top was just recently criticized in a report by a group in D.C. called the Broader Boulder Approach and the American Association of School Superintendents. And what they concluded is it's not working. I said it 3 years ago that it wasn't going to work because it's NCLB 2.0. It's more teaching to the test. It's demoralizing teachers. It's leading to more school closures. And the bottom line is, why are we racing to the top? What is the top? I don't know what the top is. Do you know what the top is? I mean, we're talking about our children. Do you want your family to race to the top in the neighborhood? Where's the top of the neighborhood? Is that the biggest house? Winners and losers, that's what a race to the top is about. But the promise of American public education is equality of educational opportunity, not a market-based system of winners and losers. And then comes the narrative on which these hoaxes are built, and the narrative is another hoax. It's the narrative that says our public schools are declining and failing. The spending has doubled, achievement is flat, our schools are broken, our schools are obsolete, the test scores are declining, the graduation rates are a scandal, we have a dropout crisis, we're losing the international competition. What I show in my book and a series of chapters called The Facts About Test Scores, The Facts About the International Test Scores, The Facts, all of this is wrong. Test scores today, and I'm looking only at the federal exam, which is called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. I was 7 years on the board of NAEP, as it's called. The test scores today are the highest they've ever been in history for white students, black students, Hispanic students, and Asian students. The highest they've ever been in history. Will you hear that from any of the leaders of the reform movement? No, because they're perpetuating the hoax of failure. Graduation rates, high school graduation rates, are the highest they've ever been in history for white students, black students, Hispanic students, and Asian students. You won't hear that either, but I have the graphs in my book. They all come right off the U.S. Department of Education website. Why can I read it and nobody else can? I can't figure this part out. Then you hear we have the dropout crisis. The dropout rates today are the lowest they have ever been in American history. That's another big surprise. It was a surprise to me. And then comes this complicated story about the international test scores. You hear these numbers, we're 14th, we're 12th, we're 26th, whatever the numbers are. It's all nonsense. The first international tests were given in 1964. We came in last. And in the 50 years since then, we have surpassed all the other 11 nations because the test scores really were not a predictor of our economy, our military supremacy, our technological innovation. They were just test scores. Now, I'm not saying that test scores don't matter, but they don't predict anything. They don't predict the future. And in fact, when people tell you about the terrible test scores, they're talking about the test that was given in 2009 called PISA, but they don't tell you about the even more recent international test called TEMS, in which our students tied with Finland in mathematics. Black students in Massachusetts got the same scores as the students of Finland in fourth and eighth grade mathematics. Well, should that have been a headline? No, of course it should have been, but you didn't hear about that. The only person who wrote about it, actually, there's a blog called The Daily Howler by Bob Summerby, and he writes about the media. And he said, look at these headlines. They say we're falling behind again. Nonsense. We did just as well as all the other European countries, and the countries with higher scores were these test-obsessed cultures like Singapore, Japan, Hong Kong, where their ministers of education are trying to figure out how can we back away from this test obsession because we don't have any creativity. What has made this a great country is not our test scores, but our creativity, our risk-taking, our innovation. And then comes the hoax that says the private sector does it better. Wrong. Here's what the private sector does. It's what the private sector does very well. They engage in risk management. You get rid of the losers and you keep the winners. It's like this strategy that many school districts have been sold called the portfolio strategy. It's treating your schools as if you had a stock portfolio. You close the low-performing schools and you keep the high-performing schools. But we're talking about children's lives. We're not talking about stocks. And what the charter schools do is the same strategy of risk management. And that is to say, the way to get high scores is to keep out the kids with severe disabilities, keep out the children who are English language learners or take very few of them, kick out the kids who get low test scores, and then say, voila, a miracle. Sorry. A couple of years ago, debated Jeffrey Canada on national television and asked him the question, what? You have a miracle school. Why did you kick out the entire entering grade in the third year? And he denied it on TV, but he did. He kicked out the entire first class because in 3 years he was unable to match the scores of some other charter school. And so one day in May, he called the kids in and he said, because his board told him they were very embarrassed by the test scores, and he said to the kids, you're out of here. The entire grade was dismissed. Can't do that in a public school. But that's risk management. Then we hear that technology is going to bring about amazing progress. Now, I'm not opposed to technology. I use it about 24/7. And we all do, and we all will, and our kids need to learn technology. But we're being sold a bill of goods. Pennsylvania is the state that has more cyber charters than any other state in the country. They are a sham. They're a scam. They rip off every district in the state. They recruit and recruit and recruit. They bring in the kids. The kids drop out. They have a very high dropout rate. The kids who stay have very low test scores, very low graduation rate. There's a real big problem with motivation. But the biggest of these cyber charters is K-12, which is listed on the New York Stock Exchange. The CEO comes, his educational background is McKinsey and Goldman Sachs. And he's paid $5 million a year, not based on the performance of the school, of the schools all over the country, but rather on enrollment, because the nature of these companies is they have to keep the enrollment up. And there are many teachers who are monitoring anywhere from 100 to 150 children. That is not education. And it's also a way of transferring public dollars into a corporation to give a computer to homeschoolers. And so the state is paying $10,000, and the parents get nothing from it except for the computer, whatever that may cost. But it's a ripoff of the state. And I can't tell you how many hundreds of millions of dollars your state has wasted on these cyber charters, nor can I tell you, because I haven't calculated, how many thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of dollars the cyber charter operators have donated to politicians in the state of Pennsylvania. And I have a chapter in the book, I think it's chapter 17, called Trouble in Eland, where I focus on both Pennsylvania and Ohio. You happen to be the two states that are most overrun with terrible cyber charters that get terrible results and never get closed down. So there are some areas in which accountability doesn't matter. And when does accountability not matter? It's when you give a contribution to the right politicians. So another of the great ideas to which we have to give ill credit to raise to the top is this idea that you can find teachers who are bad based on the test scores of their students. This is a very stupid idea. The reason I call it a stupid idea is that there is a mountain of research that shows that you don't identify teacher quality by looking at test scores. What you're identifying is who are the students in the class. And this teacher who has, let us say, class of gifted children has kids who come in who are already at the ceiling, and the computer says she's supposed to get them even higher, and she can't get them past the ceiling. So she gets a very low rating because she didn't get a big test score bump. The teacher who's teaching English language learners, her kids may not go up as much as the computer thinks they should, and she gets a very low rating. The teacher who is teaching the severely disabled, the same thing happens. So the teachers who are taking on the most challenging task are likeliest to get the lowest ratings. This is what the research says. The research also says that the measures, the ratings that teachers get, are so unstable that a teacher will be rated 1 year highly effective and the next year ineffective. And then when teachers are asked what happened and what changed, they say, I have no idea. I don't know why. I was doing exactly the same thing as I was doing last year. And there are districts, and there's studies coming out now about this. In Houston, they fired the teacher of the year. And there were teachers who got a bonus 1 year and were fired the next year. Nobody knows why. And one of the scholars at Teachers College, Aaron Palace, recently wrote, the truth of the matter is no one understands these very complicated formulas. No one, not even the people who designed them, understand them. So behind this desire to evaluate teachers is to find the bad teachers and fire them. And there is an economist at the Hoover Institution, Eric Hanushek, who has argued that, well, we've tried to help teachers, it didn't produce higher performance, and so the best way to see test scores go up is to fire the bottom 5 to 10% of teachers every year. What does that do for morale? Just imagine. You don't know if it's going to be you. The hatchet's over everybody's head. But the bottom line is there's no other country in the world that's doing this. If it was such a good idea, why are we the only ones who thought of it? The truth of the matter is, as Linda Darling Hammond at Stanford once said in a court case where she was testifying against the economist Eric Hanushek, you cannot fire your way to Finland. Another way to put it is you cannot fire your way to excellence. The truth is that the threat of firing, the insecurity that it introduces, the knowledge that teachers have that these measures are so unstable and so invalid and so unfair, demoralizes teachers. We have had now in the last few years report after report, one coming from the MetLife survey, which is done every year, another that was funded by Gates and Scholastic, found massive demoralization among both teachers and principals. Why? Because they live in such an insecure environment. And again, because they feel the public disrespect that's come from all of these so-called reformers who hold them accountable or who blame them for low performance and the insecurity that's been introduced into their lives and the sense that they're supposed to compete with one another for higher test scores. This is so unprofessional, and teachers want to be treated as professionals. Isn't that an odd idea? Then comes an idea that has been popularized by some of these so-called reformers, that one of the ways to improve performance is to abolish teacher tenure. Now, the reason I oppose this is because teacher tenure in K-12 does not mean the same thing it does in higher education. In higher education, when you have tenure, you do have a job for life. Unless you do something out, you know, if you go become a mass murderer, you probably will lose your job. But if you're a K-12 teacher, what it means is you have due process. Now, you have to understand that in the teaching profession, in the first 5 years after people enter it, about 40% of them leave because teaching is such a difficult job. And many teachers feel they're not getting the support they need, that they don't have the leadership they want, they don't have the family support they want. 40% of people who enter teaching who wanted to be teachers are gone. So those who survive and do get tenure have a right to a hearing if someone wants to fire them. I don't think that's such a terrible thing. I think it's basic fairness. Now, the reason that tenure matters is because absent tenure, there will not be academic freedom. Absent academic freedom, there will be parts of this country where the word evolution will never be heard again. Absent academic freedom, Students will learn nothing about climate change and global warming because it's controversial. There will be books that will be banned in their classroom because someone in the community objects to it. And that's why teachers, once they have proven themselves, once their administrators say that they're worthy of due process, after 3 or 4 years or whatever the state law is, should have tenure. And those rabble-rousers who go around the country saying take their tenure away are wrong because they are not considering the consequences. Now, part of the critique of teachers is based on another hoax. Maybe it's not a hoax, maybe it's just ignorance. And that is the belief that the teacher is the main determinant of whether students get higher or lower test scores. In fact, this is not true. Study after study, social science over many decades has demonstrated that the single most important predictor of test scores is family income. Family income is related to family education. It's related to opportunities. It's related to children's chances to hear a rich vocabulary, to go to the museum, to go to the library, to go to summer camp, to have family activities. And it's related to children at the other extreme not having those opportunities, not having adequate medical care, not living in a safe neighborhood. Kids start off, in some cases, heavily burdened by the circumstances of life. And of course, I'm not saying that teachers don't make a difference. I think that teachers are life changers. Teachers do make a difference. But we cannot shift the burden of society's failure onto the backs of teachers. Now, one of the other hoaxes of our day that is very puzzling is a notion that's become very popular recently, and that is that young college graduates, young people who graduated in June, can get 5 weeks of training, and they're excellent teachers by September. And what's more, they'll get higher test scores than someone who's been in the classroom for 5 or 10 or 15 years. But they'll be gone in 2 years. And we should turn over teaching to these young people, knowing that they'll be gone in 2 years and we'll have to continually replenish them with other young people. This is not what any good, high-performing country in the world does. Whether we're talking about Singapore, Japan, Finland, Canada, Australia, we're talking about countries that have built a teaching profession, not a revolving door. Now, I'm not saying this to criticize Teach for America, because I think there are some really wonderful young people who joined Teach for America. I think they're very well qualified to be teaching assistants. I think that we should consider them to be akin to the Peace Corps. No one who joins the Peace Corps is then deemed to be a Foreign Service officer. They go to the community and they do whatever work needs to be done, which they are capable of doing, and they do not become overnight ambassadors or foreign service officers. So another hoax, which my book thoroughly debunks, is this notion that kids will get higher test scores if their teachers are offered merit pay. Now, you may have read an article the other day in one of the local papers by Michelle Rhee, saying that the solution to all of Philadelphia's problems is that you don't have performance pay. And gosh, I wish you'd read my book. Because if she did, what she'd learn is that merit pay has been tried for again and again and again for 100 years. It has never worked. And you have to ask yourself, when it fails so consistently, no matter what the reward is, why? First of all, teachers are already doing the best they know how. Offering them a reward doesn't mean they're suddenly going to say, ah, I've been hiding my good lessons. It's time to bring them out. So if you want to get better teaching, maybe you'd better do some investment in human resources and professional development and help people become better teachers. But simply dangling a reward in front of them actually is demoralizing. And the reason it's demoralizing is because it causes people to compete for the donuts, the dollars, and then they stop collaborating. And the way a school succeeds is through collaboration. You don't want teachers to sit at the table and say, I'm going to hold back and not tell them what I know about Maria or Johnny. It's my secret. No. You want them to share what they know so that together the staff can work out issues that children have. And they're not going to do that when money is the reward. And it's just never worked. Nashville tried this, had an experiment over 3 years, and the prize was $15,000 for the teachers who could raise scores. And at the end of the three-year experiment, both the control group and the experimental group got the same results. The money didn't make any difference. It's been tried. It was tried in Chicago. It was tried in New York with a somewhat different plan. And yet people just can't give up this belief that performance pay and merit pay is going to make kids work harder. It's not the teachers that need to work harder. It's the kids. I remember Al Shanker once saying many years ago, let me get this straight. The kids are going to work harder because you're offering the teacher a prize. No, I don't get it. Now, another of the hoaxes that is really frustrating is when you hear the reformers say, oh, don't talk about poverty. Poverty is an excuse. Let's ignore the fact that the top 10% in this country are now accumulating more than 50% of the income. That doesn't matter. Let's keep that out of the discussion. Let's not talk about the income inequality in this country that now is larger than at any point in the past century. Let's not discuss that. The fact is, poverty really hurts kids. When kids don't get medical treatment, when they don't have an eye checkup and they have vision problems, when they don't see a dentist, when they don't have their hearing checked, when they have asthma, when they have some other illness that's totally preventable but they haven't seen a doctor, that hurts. When they don't know if they're going to have a meal at home, when they don't know if they're going to have a home, all these things get in the way of concentrating on schoolwork. So when they tell you that poverty is an excuse for bad teachers, it's a hoax. What they don't want to talk about is what really matters, which is why do we tolerate the fact that almost a quarter of our children are living in poverty? And we lead the world, the advanced nations of the world, in child poverty. And the hoax that has been particularly popular in recent years is that charters and vouchers will save poor kids from failing public schools. Now, I could go into this issue of failing public schools. This actually was a term that almost didn't exist until about 12 years ago, shortly before No Child Left Behind. I had a former graduate student who did a Nexus Lexus search for the term failing schools. We didn't use that term. We talked about children with needs, children with issues, children with problems. What do we do to help kids? Instead, now we're closing their schools because the schools are failing. And so what do we know about charters? What we know is that when they serve the same children, they don't get different results. Some get high scores, some get low scores. On average, there's no difference except for the charters that have very high attrition rates and exclude the neediest children. We do know quite a lot about vouchers, and there are some good charter schools. I'm not knocking all charter schools, but we know this about vouchers. Vouchers take money directly from public education. There are now 17 states that have some form of voucher program. But there are three districts that now have a track record with vouchers. Milwaukee, which created its voucher program in 1990. Cleveland, where the voucher program started, I think it was 1995. D.C., 2003. There have been evaluations repeatedly of these three cities. There has yet to be one that says that poor kids in voucher schools do better than their peers in regular public schools. The only effect of vouchers is to take money away from the regular public schools and to create competition that benefits no one. Another one of these hoaxes is that if schools compete, they'll get better. And we know now that that's not true. Milwaukee is the perfect case of that. Milwaukee, as I said, has had vouchers since 1990. It's also had charters since 1990. So there are three sectors now, the charter sector, the voucher sector, and a shrinking public sector. But when we look at the National Assessment of Educational Progress and compare how cities are doing, Milwaukee is one of the lowest performing cities in the United States. So the rising tide lifted no boats in Milwaukee. Competition did nothing. And then when the reformers want to say, but privatization will create dramatic gains. Look at New Orleans. Schools are so much better now than they were before the hurricane. And the hurricane was, wiped out the unions. That was a great thing, they say. And it also wiped out public education. And now more than 80% of the kids in charters, and they're making gains every year. What they don't tell you is that the New Orleans district, the recovery school district, is out of 70 districts in the state of Louisiana, depending on how you count it, they're either number 69 or 70 in the entire state. They are one of the worst districts in the entire state of Louisiana. But they're better than they were last year. They're just all low-performing schools. Now, there's also, amongst the hoaxes, this idea that the way to really fix schools is to close them. This is called a turnaround. I find this term turnaround so objectionable because it sounds like it's such a nice word. It sounds like a dance around a maypole, doesn't it? We're going to do a turnaround. We're going to close your school, fire the staff, and send the kids someplace else. This does nothing to help the children. It doesn't help children learn to read. It doesn't help children learn to speak English if they don't speak English. It decimates communities. And it deprives the communities of what was the anchor in the heart of the community. It's a terrible thing to close a school. The only reason to close a school is if everybody moves away and there are no children there anymore. Now, another hoax that's very popular in some states is that if kids can't pass the test, the way to fix that problem is to make the test harder. What we need is rigor. And I spent several years blogging with my dear friend Deborah Meyer, and she said to me, whenever you hear the word rigor, think of rigor mortis. But here's the thing with making the test harder. If a child can't jump over the bar when it's set at 4 feet, it really won't help if you raise it to 6 feet. You'll just have more kids falling and not making it over the bar. It's help that's needed, not higher standards and harder tests. And then we have what I consider another. I don't know which of these is the greatest hoax, but the hoax is anyone can teach, anyone can be a principal, anyone can be a superintendent. This is such forward thinking that it takes us right back to the early 19th century. There's also the hoax that testing is the best measure of school quality. That's wrong. Testing, especially standardized testing, is a measure of family income and education. And as I said before, it is a measure of opportunity to learn, not capacity to learn. Now, the problem that we had in New York just recently when we introduced the Common Core test is that the tests were given in April. The results came back in August. And no one's allowed to see the questions or the answers or how kids performed. They just get scores. Now, you have to step back a minute and say, what's the purpose of testing? The purpose of testing is a diagnostic. It's supposed to say to you quickly, not 6 months later, Johnny's having trouble with addition, subtraction, fractions, whatever. Maria needs help with something else. And the standardized test, they won't let you see the questions or the answers. So you it has no diagnostic purpose. It's as if you went to the doctor and he said, you do have a problem. Come back in 6 months. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I've got some medicine for you. So what I consider the biggest hoax of all is the claim that's frequently made that privatization through charters and vouchers is the civil rights issue of our time. And someone just sent me an article from a North Carolina newspaper where someone made the claim, if Dr. King were alive today, he would be fighting for choice to get kids out of public schools, which is an outrage. This is a siren song whose purpose is to turn parents into consumers instead of citizens. Citizens recognize that they have a responsibility for the common good. Consumers look out only for what's best for themselves and their own children. We all have an obligation to support public schools. It's in the interest of our society. It's in the interest of the common weal and the common wealth. We cannot just say, this is good for my child and tough for you. You live in Philadelphia, that's your problem. No, it's our problem. So into this discussion, I would like to inject a few realities. One is that children start off life with different advantages and different disadvantages, and that society has an obligation to try to level the playing field. Schools are part of that. Schools can help, but they cannot do it alone. There is an achievement gap on the first day of school. It starts at home when children are exposed to different opportunities and vocabulary and experiences. And so when I finished my last book, you know, the critics said, you don't have solutions. So where are your solutions? So I had to write this book because I have solutions. The first is we should provide, as a society, for prenatal care for all women who cannot afford prenatal care. I'm saying this as a practical matter because the research is, again, overwhelming and documented in my book, that women who do not get prenatal care are apt to have children with developmental delays and cognitive deficiencies. And these children will then go into special education, and we will pay, as a society, hundreds of thousands of dollars when we might have helped those women to have healthy babies with a very small investment at the beginning. And there was a survey done last year by the March of Dimes in the United Nations. And when we talk about rankings, when you hear somebody say, you know, we're 32nd, we're 12th, we're whatever the number, think about this. They found that we were, I think it was number 130 in the world, ranking alongside Somalia in the provision of prenatal care for women. That's a disgrace. Let's talk about that instead of test scores. We should have early childhood education for all children. Again, the research on this is indisputable. And yet, The Economist magazine last year ranked the European nations and North American nations. We came in 24th in the provision of high-quality early childhood education. We're not doing a good job on that one. What do we need to help children achieve and do well in school and be ready for school? We need smaller classes. The research is very clear that especially in the early grades and especially for children who are having learning problems, smaller classes allows them to have more time with their teacher, and this is very important for them. What else do we need? We need, in every school, a full and rich curriculum, including the arts and physical education, history and literature, science, mathematics, foreign languages. This is what we expect as a matter of course. I went to school in public schools of Houston, Texas. We had all those things, and I wasn't in a private school. It wasn't a well-funded school. Why were we able to do it so many decades ago, and we can't afford to do this anymore? I don't understand it. Is it because we're diverting all that money to testing corporations and to consultants? We have our priorities messed up. Now, here's another thing that would raise achievement across the board, and that would be to attach a health clinic to every school in a poor community. At the very least, schools should have school nurses to refer children to the health clinic that they need. Schools need wraparound services. They need parent education, adult education, school psychologists, social workers, librarians, after-school programs, summer programs. But they don't have it. But if we cared about the achievement gap, the opportunity gap, those are the things we would be doing, and we're not doing it. And this is, I know it is a somewhat controversial statement in the city of Philadelphia. We need democratic control of our schools. Having lived in a city where we have not had democratic control of our schools for the past dozen years, I can tell you that parents are itching to be able to have something to say about what the decisions made about their children. Every community should be able to vote in the people who care about their schools and vote out the people who make bad decisions. Now, I mentioned before that I'm not, despite the things that I've said, not opposed to all charters altogether. I think that charter schools were initially supposed to work as collaborators with public schools around the needs of children. I think there should be charters for children who are not making it in the public schools, where they can try new ways of doing things and help the public schools do a better job. There should be charter schools for dropouts. There should be charter schools for children who are autistic. There should be charter schools that meet the needs of children and not charter schools that skim off the best kids and leave the worst and the rejects to the public schools. And then I want to mention what I consider to be the biggest problem in this society, and that is that we tolerate the most important causes of low academic achievement, which are poverty and racial segregation. We have become indifferent as a society. We now live with the philosophy that the poor will always be with us and we don't care. We live with the belief that the Brown decision never happened and it's all over. We applaud schools that are all black or all Hispanic or all white, and that's wrong. We should be aiming to integrate our society with governmental incentives. Just think of that. $5 billion that's been wasted on Race to the Top were used to incentivize communities to have more integration in their schools. We might look like a different society today, just in a few short years. Another thing we can do, which is one of my solutions, and I have a chapter devoted to it, is the importance of strengthening the education profession. Teachers must have at least a full year of professional education and practice teaching before they're allowed to be called a teacher. Those who are principals should be master teachers. It is the principals who will evaluate the teachers. They cannot evaluate them, and they cannot help them unless they themselves are master teachers. Superintendents should be experienced educators who understand teaching and learning, not generals, not admirals, not businessmen, and not lawyers. Tests should be used appropriately. They should not be used as carrots or sticks. Standardized tests should be used sparingly. And right before we came in here, I showed Randy something that two of our great testing experts said. They said that there's no other country that tests every child every year. We're the only one. In other countries, children are tested twice or three times at most in the course of their education, plus end-of-course exams. But year-to-year testing is a huge waste of money. So standardized tests should be used preferably on a sampling basis and should be used sparingly. And as I said before, the results of the standardized tests come in too late to be diagnostically used. Too much emphasis on testing narrows the curriculum only to what's tested. And personally, I believe that most testing should be created by teachers. Now, in the things that I've said about teacher evaluation, I did not mean to imply that it's unimportant. I think that all teachers should be evaluated, but they should not be evaluated by test scores. They should be evaluated by the professional judgment of their peers and their master teachers who are their principals. The system that I am familiar with that I think it seems to me to be the best one in the country, unless Race to the Top kills it, is in Montgomery County, and it's called the Peer Assistance and Review. Now, Peer Assistance and Review works like this. If a new teacher comes into the system, He or she is assigned a mentor teacher who works with the teacher and helps them become better, and who then reports to a committee of teachers and principals about the progress of that teacher. If an experienced and tenured teacher burns out, or the principal says, this teacher is not doing a good job, I think the teacher is incompetent, that teacher is not fired on the spot. They are given a master teacher who is a mentor, who then reports to the same committee, I think that Mr. Jones or Ms. Jones has made great progress, they should be continued, or I think Mr. Jones is had it and it's time to let them go. Now, under peer assistance and review, Montgomery County has in fact fired over 200 teachers, but done in a professional way, not based on test scores, but by the judgment of qualified peers. This is something that has been considered very popular both with teachers and principals and the union because it's done collaboratively. Schools that are struggling should get timely help. They should not be closed. Maybe they need smaller classes for children who can't read. Maybe they need extra social workers. Maybe they need more bilingual instructors. We must treasure public education. We must make it stronger. We must make it better. It belongs to all of us. We're all responsible to support it, whether we have children in public schools or not, whether we're childless, and whether we send our children to private or religious school. Public education is a public responsibility. The purpose of education is not to race to higher test scores, but to prepare our children for the duties and responsibilities of citizenship. What matters most is that we have schools where students learn to think about the consequences of their actions, where they learn to treat others with respect, where they learn how to live and work in a world of rapid change with unpredictability about what the jobs of the future will be, and where they gain the knowledge and the skills that they need to make our society more just, more civil, and to bring us to that day when there is, in fact, liberty and justice for all. I should mention that I'm actually very optimistic. I see resistance building to all of these hoaxes across the country. I see the state of Texas rolling back testing of all places. I see teachers in Seattle saying, no, we will not give that test. I see parents and communities saying, we will not allow our children to take that test. It's unnecessary. We won't do it. We will stop this machine because it's not working for our kids. And so I feel very optimistic about the future. Let me conclude now by quoting the ending of my book. And it goes like this. This is a reading. Yes, we must improve our schools. We must start here, start now, by building the bonds of trust among schools and communities. The essential mission of the public schools is not merely to prepare workers for the global workforce, but to prepare citizens with the minds, hearts, and characters to sustain our democracy in the future. Genuine school reform must be built on hope, not fear, on encouragement, not threats, on inspiration, not compulsion, on trust, not carrots and sticks, on belief in the dignity of the person, not a slavish devotion to data, on support and mutual respect, not a regime of punishment and blame. To be lasting, school reform must rely on collaboration and teamwork among students, parents, teachers, principals, administrators, and local communities. Despite its faults, the American system of democratically controlled schools has been the mainstay of our communities and the foundation for our nation's success. We must work together to improve our public schools. We must extend the promise of equal educational opportunity to all the children of our nation, protecting our public schools against privatization and saving them for future generations of American children is the civil rights issue of our time. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.